Retina Rounds, podcast number 10. For the past week, Retina Rounds has been honored to welcome Dr. Mayank Bansal as our guest surgeon. He has shared a wide spectrum of educational vitreoretinal surgical videos, and now we're honored to welcome him for our podcast interview. Dr. Bansal is the founder and director of Claritas Eye and Retina Center in Delhi, India, and has trained throughout the world, including the famous All India Institute of Medical Sciences in New Delhi, India, the Royal College of Surgeons in Glasgow, UK, the Stein Eye Institute at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a research fellowship at Stanford University. Dr. Bansal talks about strategies to address healthcare needs and access in India, as well as innovation using CRISPR gene editing technology for inherited retinal dystrophies. Let's check it out.
Well, welcome to Retina Rounds, everybody. It is a great pleasure to have Dr. Mayank Bansal from India joining us. We've had the opportunity to know each other for a number of years now, and India is famous for the quality of its physicians and surgeons, and I'm pleased to introduce you to Mayank Bansal, who, if you don't already know him, you will shortly, because he's one of the rising stars in our field and certainly been a pleasure to work with on our team. Mayank, welcome to Retina Rounds podcast.
Thank you, Dr. Steve. It's been a pleasure to be a part of this.
It's really great. Your cases this week have been absolutely stunning, and the responses from around the world have been fantastic. Tell us a little bit about your journey to becoming a vitreoretinal surgeon. Where did you grow up and where did you train?
So I grew up in New Delhi, and I, after taking up medicine, was very inclined towards a surgical specialty. I was particularly drawn on the hands-on aspect of things. And within that, I was especially drawn towards getting vision back. So that's how I chose ophthalmology. And during residency, I was further intrigued how all of what you can do with the vision aspect comes down to taking care of the retina. And that's how I chose vitreoretinal surgery.
Oh, that's very exciting. Where did you study before medical school?
So before medical school was in Delhi as well. I trained at All India Institute of Medical Sciences, New Delhi, for my residency and fellowship for retina as well over there.
And that's a very, very competitive system that you live in. For our listeners around the world, tell us about the pyramidal structure that you had to navigate to get there. I mean, many smart people fall off the path and move into other specialties. So where are the pitfalls for a trainee coming up in India?
So yeah, undoubtedly, it's very, very coveted to become a doctor in India. And it's a highly competitive exam. You give a pre-medical test to enter into medical school. That's immediately after high school, as against the United States, where you do a graduation. And right after that, during the end of the medical school, there's a year of internship, and that's when you prepare for your residency exams. So once you do clear the residency exams, again, extremely pyramidal, very, very competitive, and then thereafter, the senior residency or the fellowship exams. So I'm not sure of the numbers, but yeah, it is extremely competitive there.
So how is it that somebody that comes through such a competitive system turns out to be so kind and nice and gentle with your colleagues?
You're being extremely kind as well, but it's I think medicine as a specialty makes you very, it's a very humbling experience. The difficulties that you see people go through while you're in clinics, while the hospitals, you realize that you're so much more privileged and there is so much more that can be done.
And how does the system work in India in terms of who has access to care? Many people understand the systems of their own country, but like, for example, you've worked with us in Los Angeles and you know the struggles that we have in the American healthcare system. Everybody wants access, everybody wants affordability, and everybody wants it now. And we always struggle with one of those three pieces of the triangle. How does it work in India? Are there long wait times, or is there a struggle with access? Do you have to be privileged to be able to get into the doctor, or do the public hospitals and clinics handle that? How does that work?
Yeah, I suppose within India, there are many Indias, if I was to say. So, generally speaking, majority have access to public care, but private care, which in which the patient or the person pays out of their own pocket, is something which is becoming more and more popular, so as to say. Within the rural areas, the villages, it's something known as a primary health center, and after about 5 primary health centers, it makes into a community health center. So primary health center would cater to a village with a population of about 5,000 people. A community health center would cater to about 30,000 people. That's where you could do a basic kind of procedure, like basic eye procedures or even a cataract surgery. And then there's further referral centers, and then the apex center. So for example, where I trained is called the Rajendra Prasad Center for Ophthalmic Sciences, which is the apex center within the pyramid. So that's how the eye care aspect is structured, along with, of course, all the other specialties. That's the government aspect of it. And that's the government funded or the public care. And then there's the private care, wherein there are hospitals, so private practices which are running, or multi-specialty corporate hospitals, which are funded by bigger companies or so. So these three would be largely the structures.
Interesting. And so now you're working in your own clinic in the city, and do you have your own theaters attached to your clinic, or do you go somewhere else to operate?
Yes, so I have a eye center, an eye hospital, where we have an operating theater with a cataract and retina surgery clinic running, and we have OT running, as well as a facility where we have four consultants who are visiting our facility. And aside from that, I'm also affiliated to a multi-specialty hospital. So for patients who would, so this would be an ambulatory care facility which I'm running. And aside from that, it's a multi-specialty hospital that I'm affiliated to. So any patient who needs a cardiac care or monitoring or post-procedure overnight admissions, we would plan their procedures over there.
Now, this week, one of the most striking videos you showed was some really chronic intraocular foreign bodies. And it struck me that beautiful surgeries, beautiful outcomes, doesn't surprise me. You've got beautiful hands and do a great job. But why were the patients so delayed? Is it part of the system? Did they come from rural areas? Tell us the story of those patients.
So these were cases, patients that we'd seen at Rajendra Prasad Center, and these were patients who had delayed in referrals, so access to the retina care. To some extent, you could say misinformation as well. Just being informed that maybe not much can be done for something like this or so, and by the time they did reach a retina facility, that's what it was, about 2 to 3 months. So that's where the delay in the taking out of the foreign bodies.
And is that sort of a common occurrence there?
It's changing, but previously it was further inaccessible, but now more and more access is, I think, as more and more people are getting trained and moving out to different parts of the country, I think the access is becoming more and more feasible for a lot more people.
And is there an aspect of that has to do with training the regional physicians or in the smaller health centers where they learn, maybe they make the diagnosis or they have an idea that there's a piece of metal or cement or whatever at the back of the eye, but they're learning that this actually can be coped with rather well by a surgeon in town. And so is that part of the challenge is getting the local docs educated to what you can do and what the outcomes are, or is it more to do just with straight access and the patient care?
Both aspects of it, both the knowledge and as well as the access, I think both contribute to it.
You know, it's not different than what we have here in California. We've got some very rural areas where patients will show up a few months after something and they'll have been told nothing can be done. And we of course think we can help them and try to. And so it's not an altogether different situation. What's the greatest challenge you face? You live in a country not unlike ours, where there's great sophistication, great wealth, but it's concentrated at the very top. And then there's this huge spectrum of, I don't want to use the wrong term, but people who haven't been as fortunate and who are either less educated or less financially blessed. And so there's this great disparity in our country, as you know from having been here for a while. Healthcare access, there's great disparity. There's great socioeconomic disparity. What are the great challenges that you face in dealing with that huge gap?
So I would perhaps put it this way that I feel having more and more of surgeons or access in the peripheries would definitely both be benefit the patients as well as the surgeons as well in some sense. But I think how it can be done more doable is to make the peripheries more accessible, maybe perhaps better schools for doctors who would like to move out to the peripheral centers, and better infrastructure over there. Those would encourage more and more people to move in the peripheries as take things up. So I've also had colleagues who've stayed there, found things a little difficult, and then come back to the cities again. So that's from the physician perspective. And I'm sorry, did I catch the patient perspective of it as
Absolutely,
well?
please tell us. Yes.
So from the patient's perspective, I think again, as the healthcare facilities do get more advanced in the peripheries, direct access can be done. So just the example of the foreign body, retina surgery could have been done at other states or cities, and the patients needn't have really waited for all of those things. On the note of the foreign bodies, I really wanted to say that perhaps legislations around protective eyewear. So, for example, when people are on motorbikes in the city, it's compulsory for them to wear helmets. So, any worker who's working, a polycarbonate glasses, if that was a legislation, so much of this could have been prevented. Another very related thing that I feel very strongly about, I'm deviating a little from the topic, but it has been around firecracker injuries. So around Diwali, it's heartbreaking for us to see people get trauma, eye trauma, because of firecracker injuries. So information, so social media perhaps in that sense has helped a lot. Me, my colleagues, a lot of people are putting out that word out there that don't burst firecrackers, don't burst them in these ways. It's not only damaging the body, it also affects, there's some amount of child labor and all also that goes into it. So these things with related to eye trauma particularly are something which people can be made more aware of within the country.
Right. Tell us, what are the trends that you face disease-wise? So are you seeing increased diabetes, diabetic eye disease, or a decrease? Are you seeing increased macular neovascularization or a decrease, whether it's macular AMD type? Like, how much AMD do you see in India, in the Indian population?
So both diabetic retinopathy and AMD on an increase, diabetic retinopathy way more than AMD. And yeah, it's again very, very surprising. And that's where perhaps information helps a lot to see people living within the city with access to healthcare, not being aware of the effect of diabetes on the eye. And we see sometimes 40-year-olds with full PDRs. Just coming with that vitreous hemorrhage, which is very profound now, just ignoring the floaters until there were many, many episodes of small bleeding, and then eventually deciding to come down. So that's the diabetic retinopathy aspect. It's a major, major concern. How we try and do our bit is, of course, have that certain times get those camps or information out, both in person as well as via social media, and get more information out there. Coming to AMD with the more aging population, of course, we see more patients with AMD. So accessibility and patient access acceptance towards anti-VEGF injections for wet AMD is becoming more and more popular, aware. So when more people know, for example, everyone's aware of cataract surgery, so people have more acceptance towards intravitreal injection as well when it comes to wet AMD. So it's not as a big surprise. With an aging population, definitely it's on the rise. Dry AMD, of course, remains a challenge. So
So you see plenty of maculopathy, age-related maculopathy, whether it's angiogenic or atrophic, in the Indian population as the population ages. And is it predominantly atrophic or predominantly neovascular or sort of the same mix that we see in our, you have a more homogeneous population, I think, than we do, in the sense that you've got
yes,
the
that's true.
East Asian population, whereas here in Los Angeles, we've sort of got a little bit of everything. Demographically. And so in the Indian population, you're seeing, which are you seeing more of? Is it more atrophic or is it more neovascular?
It's really a mix of both. So the surgical cases as well, I showed some of the PCV submacular bleeds. So PCV by itself, neovascular AMD and dry. It's a mix.
Now, in the polypoidal cases, I was wondering, are your patients frequently anticoagulated for other reasons and that's why they're hemorrhaging? Or are you seeing, and when they are, do you ring the physician and talk to them about how many agents they're on? Here, we see patients that are shopping doctors, and one doctor's putting them on one drug, and one doctor's putting them on another drug, and they show up and they're on two or three anticoagulants, and they just think that each doctor automatically knows what they're on, even though they haven't been giving them the history maybe so accurately. And so we do a lot of sleuthing around as the doctor that's caring for the hemorrhagic complications. Or are you seeing it as a blood pressure manifestation, hypertensive manifestation, or just natural history of the disease?
I'd say more so the natural history. It's been one odd patients, few patients who have been on anticoagulants and hypertension, but I would say about 70% would be natural history and 15% of hypertension and anticoagulants.
And how do you treat most of your PCV patients, your polypoidal patients, before they hemorrhage? Are you treating them with anti-VEGF or are you watching them or are you photodynamic therapy? What's your go-to?
So PDT was something that we were doing until 2017, 18, but post that, it's largely been anti-VEGF therapy, and newer drugs are taking more and more acceptance. So with brolucizumab, for example, there was that concern around the inflammation, but we've seen that lesser and lesser. And with the aflibercept, of course, has been one of the most popular, as well as ranibizumab. So there are some biosimilars that have been developed within India, so they're gaining more and more traction. They reduce the cost of the treatment. Bevacizumab has largely been reduced or discontinued. There is always that concern around endophthalmitis with the multiple dispensing of it, and now with faricizumab being there for about a year, year and a half now, so that's also gaining more acceptance. Since we reduced the frequency of the injections with that,
And which
cost
do you
remains a
feel,
factor.
of course, but in a cost-free world, which do you prefer for your PCV patients, or do you tailor it to a certain finding?
No, so with Webis, with faricizumab, we've been seeing more and more better outcomes, I would say, but cost definitely remains a factor there. So there are certain patient support programs. I'm not sure if they're there in the United States at the moment. So
No, they
wherein
come and
the
go. You're very prescient. They come and
Correct.
go. Right now, they're gone. So there aren't as many patient assistance programs as there once were.
So it's almost as in the next injection is covered by the company. So that definitely brings down the cost.
And do you find that the patients hemorrhage more if you treat and extend too far? Like, are you seeing a rebound effect coming off of anti-VEGF therapy?
So the ones that have had hemorrhage have been the ones who've either not received therapy or have trailed off it. So, but yeah, if there's a patient who's visiting you, then you'd rarely get to that stage.
So if they're coming in regularly.
Yes.
Isn't that interesting? And
I'm
what
sure that's been
about,
your experience as well.
oh, absolutely, absolutely. That and the anticoagulation. But, here in Southern California, we have a fair amount of PCV. It's not an absolute hotbed like yours. We see a lot more garden variety, or I don't know whether you say bog standard in Delhi, whatever it is, just typical angiogenic AMD, wet AMD, as opposed to PCV. But we do have a big population that fits the demographics, and we've seen a lot of it. We've had a lot of names for it over the years, and the hemorrhages, you manage them beautifully on the surgical videos. They're very instructive. What about peripheral retinal vascular proliferation, Eales disease, so to speak? And how do you think about that?
Very
Are
common,
tell us about it, because
extremely.
we don't see it that often. So share how do patients present? When do you suspect it, and how do you deal with it?
So typically, 15, 20-year-old young male, 20 years to 30 years of age, episodes of floaters, that's when they'll typically come. And when you examine, it can range from anything. It could be just a one neovascularization which has bled, or there might be multiple areas which are there. Seen the whole spectrum from just an inflammatory as well, wherein there's the macular edema because of the inflammatory aspect of it. But most often it's a vitreous hemorrhage that a patient presents with. So we try and investigate. The most of the investigations come out to be negative, right from all the infective and non-infective causes, especially looking out for tuberculosis, a Mantoux test, chest X-ray, and so on. But most of them, they come out to be negative. And the
Run down your,
treatment.
sorry for interrupting, but run down your workup specifically for Eales disease. So you got a young 20-year-old man comes in with a new vitreous hemorrhage, and is it unilateral, bilateral? Typically, do you take a close look in the fellow eye? Are there hints there of what's going on in the medical history?
Yeah.
So teach us about
So,
it. What's the workup?
okay. So typically it'll be one eye having a vitreous hemorrhage. The other eye may have some component of vasculitis that's happening, but typically unilateral. When there is a vitreous hemorrhage, there may be an associated traction in the periphery. So basis that, of course, we do a retinal imaging from an ophthalmic workup point of view, a retinal imaging, fluorescein angiography, typically yes, to look at which areas are ischemic and which are active, where we are seeing the NVs, especially for the fellow eye. And OCT, of course, to see for any macular edemas. They're typically not there, but may do exist. And from a blood workup, both the infective and non-infective aspects. So infective would be around tuberculosis, syphilis, VDRL. We would also rule out HIV, HBs antigen, HCV. From a non-infective, sarcoid, serum calcium, ACE, ANA, CNCA. So typically run all of these just to be sure that we're not missing anything.
What are you ordering
And
a serum calcium for?
for sarcoid, so it would be raised in sarcoids. So
And which tuberculosis blood test do you do?
so typically it wouldn't show up. There's Mantoux that we typically try and get it done. And aside from that, a chest X-ray, if there are any coexisting lesions in the lungs. And again, both the Mantoux and the chest X-ray do come out to be negative. The Mantoux, but not of and the chest X-ray would come out to be negative. So that's when you start off the patient on either steroids if there is an inflammatory component which is already there. If the vessels are not showing any kind of a sheathing, they're not inflamed, then would go ahead with a scatter laser in areas where there are NVEs and there is visible retina. There's no vitreous hemorrhage. And again, it depends if it's in the inflammatory stage or if it's in the neovascular thing. So if in case it's in the inflammatory stage, we first take down the inflammation with both systemic steroids. and topical is necessary. Typically, systemic in case it's bilateral, and if it's unilateral, we might even choose to give a peribulbar shot of steroid. And once the inflammation is brought down, then go ahead with the scatter laser. And if there is a very profound amount of retinal vitreous hemorrhage, it's not been clearing, or there is tractional detachment, which is not just in the periphery, but it's also threatening the macula, so then we would go ahead with a vitrectomy to take it out.
Right. And when you do the
Most often,
laser, go ahead. I'm sorry.
no, sorry, most often it's a vitreous hemorrhage, which has been non-resolving as well. When it comes to a surgical case, you do a B scan prior if you don't have any view of the retina to just rule out if there's any tractional detachment. But prognosis remains very good for most cases. But then there are those occasional cases where there are tractional detachments, multiple ones. Sorry, you were saying.
I was just going to say, when you do your scatter laser, is it always anterior? The ischemia is typically anterior to the proliferation, so you're not treating the areas that are perfused. So are you guiding that with clinical findings or angiography, or is your scatter pattern for EELs different than it is for other retinal vascular diseases?
So yeah, typically anterior to the neovascularization, but some of the cases, for example, will have a neovascularization at the disc, optic disc. So that's when you would choose to go ahead with a PRP laser.
Right. And the prognosis for these cases is usually pretty good or pretty guarded. Do they recur? Do they progress after surgery and laser? What, tell us about that natural history.
So it tends to be recurrent. It typically tends to die out by 35 or 40 years of age. It doesn't become as aggressive, but between 20, 25 to 40, it's pretty recurrent. You see inflammation coming every now and then. So we do keep the patients on follow-up every 3 months or 6 months. And yeah, so post-surgeries, typically once the PRP is done, however, and it's been someone who had a full-blown condition with the vitreous hemorrhage and tractional detachment. So they tend to somehow quieten down post all the procedures. They don't tend to have as much of a recurrent bleed or inflammation. But someone who's been in an inflammatory stage, who's received steroids mainly for maybe two quadrants of the retina periphery being affected by the inflammation and new vessels, they tend to have other areas getting affected subsequently. So someone who's already advanced, has had a kind of burnout or full-blown disease, would start to regress back. But someone who's got just few areas involved, they likely have a progressive course.
Right.
And once
And
one eye is affected, then the other eye also starts to get affected. So it's sequential, bilateral,
sequential,
but sequential.
right. I, in my experience, have not managed too many acute Eels disease type patients. A few, but I've seen a lot of burnt out Eels. And so when we see them, they're bilateral and they're advanced. And so it's interesting, and you feel like you can control them pretty well and keep them seeing through the burnout phase, and so that they can have a lifetime of vision if you have access to them throughout their care. That's exciting.
Yes, absolutely.
That's exciting. Do the anti-VEGFs have a role in EELs?
Yes, we have been using them, especially perhaps prior to the procedure. And maybe if it's just an acute bleed and you want to get a view of the retina until you can laser it. So definitely, we do use anti-VEGFs.
And do you find that you can occasionally have an iatrogenic detachment from the rapid regression of the neovascularization if it's associated with traction peripherally, like we see posteriorly in diabetes, the scrunch phenomena?
Yes, it certainly does. So that's where the care that we would just give it 3 or 5 days prior to procedure.
Interesting. Interesting. And what percentage of your patients actually turn up with tuberculosis, more or less?
One, maybe 2%. It's
Right.
hardly been the case. Yes.
Right.
A tuberculosis patient would typically present with a choroidal tuberculoma, is what we typically tend to see more.
So this idea that tuberculosis is absolutely endemic is sort of a relic of the textbooks and not really the reality in modern urban India.
Yes, haven't been seeing it as much like the last decade and a half or so. Not really.
And how about HIV? Also pretty rare.
Not as common. There
Right.
are certain risk populations, but not as common.
Right. Well, that's just fascinating. Now, what about in theater? What are your big challenges at India in theater? I mean, obviously you've got super sophisticated equipment, but is it scheduling, or because you're the boss, you don't have any challenges, but is there a great giant backlog of patients for you to do, or are you triaging who's getting into theater? What are your challenges in theater?
I think it kind of differs and varies. While I was at the public hospital at the Apex Institute, Rajan Prasad Center, I think one of the major challenges was the general anesthesia time. So for all the pediatric patients, we would just be running out of the GA time because that's where anesthesiology and other departments are involved. For patients who were scheduled within our local anesthesia, monitor anesthesia care. So those perhaps not as much of a delay in scheduling. When it comes to access to private care, I think there are two aspects to it. One is the economics of it. So insurances are gaining momentum, and that's something which has made it more and more accessible to people. So people are tending to choose private care, and there wouldn't be as much of a challenge there.
So you're able to mitigate the or regulate the flow of surgeries in theater time. And are you able to take a day off once a month or once a week? Are you still working 7 days a week, 28 hours a day, or are you calming down a little bit?
No, definitely take one day off. I think it's worth it to avoid any kind of a burnout. There are phases, especially I think around residency and just after that, where you go all in the work, but then you soon realize that it's important to take that, especially one day off.
Yeah, your total immersion is a mistake. It's good to come up for air every now and again, I think. And what's the inter to go
Sorry,
ahead.
I'm curious how do you get how do you deal with burnout or
Well,
excessive work?
I've been spoiled throughout my career with such great colleagues and such, the trainees in my career were always smarter than I was and always worked harder than I did. I worked very hard, but I was very lucky. Speaking of which, are you involved in teaching now? Are you still going over and attending cases and training retina fellows and residents and so on? Tell us about what that's been like for you.
So while in the hospital, in the multi-specialty hospital, we do have certain residents. We do have a DNB program, as we call it, and along with that, we do have optometry students as well. So those would be the teaching at the moment, but not as much while I've been in private care.
And is the system similar to the American system in that the optometrists are limited in their scope of practice, or are they branching out and doing more and more in terms of diagnostics and procedures and so on?
No, I think it's they're limited in terms of the work that optometrists would be doing.
But they're, I'm sure, exceptional at what they do and very, very clever. But they're capped in their scope of practice. Is that correct?
That's right, absolutely.
And now, are you participating in or with any of the telemedicine screening programs that you had worked on while you were here?
I wanted to share a little bit about this. So while I was there at UCLA, I was particularly drawn up, and that was during my retina fellowship that I had looked up with the human embryonic stem cell program that was going on 2014, the Lancet paper that he had published, and found that bit extremely inspiring. So while reading for retina, I always felt that there are these certain amount of conditions which all have a treatment, but when it comes to dry AMD as well as retinal dystrophies, we generally tell patients that nothing can be done, nothing to be done, and have them come back until about 2016 or 17. So my fellowship getting over, as fate would have it, I got connected with a scientist who's been working on CRISPR-based gene editing. So we were just trying to explore how patients with retinal dystrophy can be treated with that. So first we realized that we're not aware of what's the mutational landscape of the patients with retinal dystrophy and started to sequence patients that were coming to the practice and with other colleagues. So we've come to realize that certain mutations are showing up way more common as compared to the others, and perhaps got to do with some degree of consanguinity, or even if not just consanguinity, tendency to have marriages within a certain community. So there's a particular gene, Circle to be exact, which is showing up more, in fact, to the community that I also belong. And it's a 30 million large community, people large community. And we're trying to basically see how we can target that using
Say the
both
name of the
gene
gene
editing
again.
tools.
Say the.
Circles. Circle as in CERKL, ceramide kinase-like protein. So we're trying to see how we can develop both a gene editing based tool as well as a gene augmentation based therapy for this. So aside from the clinical work, I've been devoting more time on that front.
How exciting. What's the functionality of the gene? Is it known?
So yes, it's more of protecting the cell against apoptosis. So if there was a mutation, it is increasing the apoptosis aspect of the photoreceptors. So that's
And
something which is getting more and more defined, but yeah, please.
what's the phenotype?
Phenotype has been pretty varied. It's been from a very classic looking retinitis pigmentosa with peripheral pigmentation and some degree of central photoreceptor loss. But there are also patients who have a Posse pigmentary, where there are just stippled, especially it's evident on autofluorescence, a stippled hypoautofluorescence in the macula, and the periphery looks very, very much untouched, very normal. So it's been a spectrum. So, which is again very, very interesting to see that a single gene having a very varied phenotype.
Not altogether uncommon, really. I remember when I was a fellow, some of my colleagues were mapping out the perforin genes and the variable penetrance and phenotypic presentations varied from an RP-like phenotype all the way to a maculopathy, and just about every variation in between. And the mutations, even within the same family. So really, really interesting. And so you're seeing an increased incidence of that particular gene abnormality showing up in a given population, and that population is about 30 million strong in India. And are you trying to characterize both the phenotype and the genotypes of all the patients? Are you seeing different mutations in the same gene, or is it all the same mutation?
Incident, yeah, interestingly, a single mutation.
Single
It's not
mutation.
throughout the gene. So that makes it again a very targetable therapy.
So somebody is truly the father of their country, and it's probably back a few generations. But and how are you? And have you? Are you planning to publish on the spectrum of the phenotype? What's your plan?
Yeah, that's something we've sent across a preprint, and that's something which is under review.
That's
So
great.
certainly it's submitted. Yeah.
That's great. Of course it is. And so when you're talking about augmenting the gene, are you talking about repairing the actual genetic material, or are you talking about augmenting the protein with a normal construct, or what's the strategy that you're thinking about?
Yeah. So that's something which is work in progress. So I'm not. But
Not going to
yeah.
spill the beans.
So
That's okay. Sorry to push the button, but it's a really great idea, and it's good to do it. And it's a challenging thing, genetic manipulation, whether it's with the CRISPR technologies or with more standard gene therapy, with a vector-driven approach, can be very exciting and very challenging at the same time. And there's a lot to be gained from participating in the process, let's just say. It's really, really great that you're doing that. Now, aspiration-wise, when you think about your region of the world, what are your hopes for the field? Are you looking towards trying to bring together the Indian retina specialists to educate the public more? So, is it public education, patient education, physician education? Is it delivery of care to the rural areas? Where does your passion lie besides the cutting-edge scientific breakthrough for these patients? I know it may seem like a lot, but I know also that you are always have your finger on the pulse of many inspirational programs. So talk to us about what you're thinking of for the future of retina care in your country.
So manifold. I think there is so much ground to cover, and it's often hard to choose or prioritize. But if I was to summarize in a few things, one, technology. I think technology by itself can really make access more and more feasible. An extremely high role of telemedicine, the portable imaging and portable screening tools are something which are extremely doable to get the access there, out there in the far areas. So, for example, in India, we have something known as an ASHA worker, who's a particular healthcare worker in a village. And if they have an access to a fundus camera and a refractometer, for example, they're able to at least get data which can be screened using the AI based tools, and then eventually decide to more have them come back, come to those who require the care, come to more specialized center. The other, I think, area, so a lot that can be done both on AI based screening along with the telemedicine, tele-ophthalmology tools for fundus imaging as well as refraction. And so the other potential is in, of course, disseminating the knowledge aspect of things. So we would want more knowledge to be out there when it comes to the most common conditions. I think everyone is now aware of cataracts, but there is not so much knowledge when it comes to diabetic retinopathy, glaucoma, and so. So just getting that knowledge out there is something which is to be worked on. And then eventually the access aspect. So while although it's concentrated mostly within the cities, I feel that with more and more people being trained within the cities, there is gaining momentum of people moving towards the other areas. Mostly people who have come from different areas of the country are setting up practices and working at hospitals within other towns or villages, and that makes it more and more accessible. So I think that's another thing which is heartening, and I'm hoping that that gains more momentum. The biotechnology and the biosciences aspect of things is where I feel that there's so much to be done, and we're hoping to be a part of it. Very recently, one of the companies within India has also been getting started a phase one to a clinical trial on retinal pigment epithelium, which is injected in the subretinal space. So similarly, on the gene therapy and gene editing fronts, also, I'm hoping that we're able to generate more and more indigenous therapies, because they will be very mutational specific to the Indian population, and hopefully which can be taken away to other areas of the world. So I think there's a lot of ground to cover, and it's always very exciting to be a part of these exciting
Yeah,
changes.
this is sort of universal changes, I can tell you, Mayank, that we're depending on you not just to prevent blindness in India, but we're leaning on India hard to help the world. So you've got a big responsibility, not just your indigenous populations, but you guys are stepping up, and you're gonna help us all. We're quite sure of it. Now, last question I
I
have
think
for you
we
about
work in conjunction, we work together, and I hope more better science comes out of it. There are a lot of advantages of things which are happening. For example, I'll just cite a few examples. While I was there at UCLA that time, the human embryonic stem cells work that you were at was very inspiring. I saw Dr. Hubschman working on robotic surgery platform for ophthalmology being developed. So that was very hands-on. I think that led me to be inspired towards how you integrate both the ophthalmology as well as the technology aspect. We then started to work on handheld, both OCT and fundus bone imaging devices. That's something which is going on in parallel. Just certain inspiration there, as well as adaption to newer technologies. So I had spent a little bit of time that time with Dr. David Sraf, and OCT Angio had just come across and come out. So a lot of inspiration on how different technologies can be looked into. So those were a certain set of seeds of thought that I had while I was there at UCLA. And I think that collaborative thing or learning from both ways. And I suppose, like you said about the retinal vasculitis aspect, the understanding of different kind of cases. So we do see a very varied spectrum of conditions because of the sheer number of people that are there and the sheer number of diseases that we perhaps see over here. So there's so much learning that can be done together. So I'm hopeful that that's where the future goes towards.
Well, you know, we certainly learn from you. The question I was going to ask you is, demographically, are you seeing more and more diabetes in India? As is the diet changing and the lifestyle changing as it goes through this modernization period, or urbanization, modernization, like we saw here in America? We've got a problem that I don't know. I know diabetes numbers are going up in India, but is it because of a more sedentary lifestyle and a more Western diet encroaching, or is it for another reason, or maybe the reason's unknown?
Yeah, no, I think a lot of it has got to do with more and more access to processed food, which is marketed. And typically, the diet was homemade food or which was naturally grown. And so, and all of the processed foods, I feel, add a lot to the simple processing of sugars and rise in the diabetes. That's a very diet base, as well as the, of course, sedentary lifestyle. And so there are so many, again, it's a full spectrum within India. There's this group or a group of people who wear healthcare and taking care of your own body and your own self is getting more and more popular. And at the same time, you do see people who are affected with more and more diabetes. So India is so varied that you see a spectrum of everything.
Right,
So it's
right,
very hard to generalize.
right, right. I'm sure it is, and of course I am generalizing, so I apologize for that. But it's just so inspirational to have a young colleague like you out there with your remarkable skill set and scientific prowess and your surgical prowess, diving into a underserved home country where you have so much to contribute. It's really a great time for you to be doing what you're doing. And here at Retina Rounds and all of our listeners around the world are inspired by, you know, your climb through this very competitive landscape to get to become a vitreoretinal surgeon, and now to be able to deliver the care both at your apex hospitals and in your own private clinic to the population there in Delhi. I hope it's something that gives you great satisfaction. It's certainly something that the retina community at large is very proud of. You know, all of us who have the privilege of training fellows and watching them go off and make contributions, we're exceptionally proud of you, Mayank, and want to thank you for taking the time to share your cases with us and to wave the Indian flag. And sue for peace, of course. We're in crazy times, so it's up to the retina specialists and our community to make the world a better place in all ways, and stay collaborative across what are geopolitically fraught times. And look forward to seeing you again at the next international conference if we can't entice you to come back to Los Angeles and visit us here. So, Mayank Bansal from New Delhi, thank you very, very much for sharing your magnificent surgical cases with us and the stories of the battlegrounds there in the vitreoretinal world of India. Thank you, Mayank.
Thank you for having me. It's been incredible talking after about all of these aspects. I hope to keep continuing to do more collaborative work. It's been incredible learning and collaborating in the past, and I look forward to it in the future.
You can count on it. We're counting on you. Thanks very, very much, Mayank, for taking the time with us.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.